It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, in Africa, top scientists say COVID-19 may already have reached its endemic phase on the continent.
I think we've reached a turning point in this pandemic. What we need to do is learn to live with the virus and get back to as much of a normal society as is possible.
Now news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. The nursing home and long-term care industry is split in its reaction to the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the federal mandate for healthcare worker vaccination. Infections are once again surging among residents and staff at nursing homes, with cases for staff at a record high. NPR's Rita Chatterjee has the details.
The American Healthcare Association, representing for-profit nursing homes and long-term care facilities, issued a statement saying that it remains concerned that the mandate will be, quote, devastating to an already decimated long-term care workforce. The group is urging CMS to consider regular testing as an alternative option for unvaccinated staff to prevent further staff shortages. But the group representing non-profit facilities responded with a statement saying that, according to a recent poll, most of its members are ready to move forward with the vaccine mandate. Rita Chatterjee, NPR News.
The government's latest retail report is the first to reflect the impact of the Omicron surge on consumer spending.
Consumers dialed back their spending in December as Omicron case counts surged. Retail sales were down 1.9% from the month before, a sharper drop than forecasters had expected. Online retailers saw the biggest decline of nearly 9%, but sales were also down at department stores, furniture stores, and bookstores. Industrial production was also down slightly last month, but mortgage rates are going up in anticipation of Federal Reserve action to combat inflation.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. The numbers were released by the Commerce Department today. Heavy snow is hammering a large portion of the nation's Midwest right now. Scores of schools were closed today or moved online. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for parts of Minnesota, the Dakotas, Iowa, and Illinois. Forecasters are expecting the area to end up with as much as 10 inches of snow, and snow is also coming to the East Coast. It was a mixed day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials closed down 201 points, the Nasdaq up 86. This is NPR News. Military personnel in Canada refusing to get the COVID-19 vaccine will face formal proceedings, and the Department of National Defense says action has already been launched against more than 900 of them. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Late last year, Canada's Chief of Defense Staff, Wayne Eyre, ordered all military personnel to certify full vaccination by mid-October. That was extended to mid-December. By the end of December, reviews had been launched against 100 members of the armed forces who repeatedly refused to be vaccinated, and 800 have been issued warnings and orders to get counseling and could be forced out of the service if they don't get their jabs. A defense spokesman says 44 members have left rather than get the dose, as well as an unknown number of reservists. A federal court has dismissed a request from several personnel to stop the military from forcing them to get vaccinated. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The Omicron variant of the coronavirus is hitting sanitation workers across the country. In some areas, the problem is so severe that garbage and recycling pickup has been delayed or suspended. In Nashville, recycling bins remain at curbside while trash bags are piling up on the streets of Philadelphia. The Biden administration is threatening to take back COVID-19 relief funds sent to Arizona, citing state provisions that effectively discourage families and school districts from following face covering guidelines for schools. Two state programs currently direct the funding away from jurisdictions that have mask requirements. The Treasury Department has given the state 60 days to remove the anti-masking provisions. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, dedicated to helping people secure their financial futures with lifetime retirement income. Learn more at tiaa.org/neverrunout. From Easy Cater, committed to helping companies solve food for work, from sales meetings to daily employee lunches, with online ordering and 24/7 support. Corporate Food Solutions at easycater.com. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles. Throughout the pandemic, we've heard that people with underlying conditions are at a greater risk for severe complications. That sentiment can often leave those people feeling vulnerable, and the way public officials talk about it can sound offensive or dismissive to them. That's what happened a few days ago after an ABC News interview with CDC Director Rochelle Walensky. It is worth noting that Walensky's comments were edited for broadcast, and the CDC said that the context had been edited out of the interview. But this afternoon, disability rights advocates met with Walensky to discuss what chronically ill, immunocompromised, and disabled Americans need from the CDC. Matthew Cortland is a senior resident fellow at Data for Progress and was present at the meeting. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So going into today's gathering, what were you hoping to help the CDC director understand?
The first thing was, it was really necessary to explain to Director Walensky why her comments, and to be clear, they were taken out of context, but in their full context, the director was saying that it was, quote, encouraging that, quote, the unwell or people with four or more comorbidities or chronic illnesses or underlying health conditions suffered 75% of COVID-19 mortality amongst those who are vaccinated. And we really needed to explain to Director Walensky that it is not encouraging to the tens of millions of Americans who are disabled, who are chronically ill, who are immunocompromised, who fall into the category she was talking about. Right. It is not encouraging to us that our people are disproportionately dying. And she needed to understand that as the very first step.
But this is about more than simply a single comment, right? Like, you have been concerned about messaging from top public health officials throughout this pandemic.
We've been concerned about policy and messaging. Ableism, or the devaluing of the lives of chronically ill, disabled, and immunocompromised people, is pervasive in public health. It was something I first learned during my graduate training in public health. Ableism is a systemic problem. It is a systemic problem in public health. It has been a systemic problem from CDC. And to be honest with you, the entire federal government, the HHS, and it is not just this one comment. You are absolutely correct. It is a pervasive policy, substantive problem that disabled, chronically ill, and immunocompromised people, literally tens of millions of us, are not being considered in the technical guidance that CDC issues or in the distribution plans of HHS. It is a large and pervasive problem.
So ultimately, how do you feel today's meeting went with Walensky?
I think it is the first step. It is a necessary first step, but it is only a first step. We really need CDC to continue to commit to partnering with the disability community to develop substantive technical guidance and policy plans that will center chronically ill, immunocompromised, and disabled people, and so that we're no longer left behind. I think we successfully educated the director, mm-hmm. and we are looking for a public apology to the disability community broadly, not just the people that she met with today, and we are looking for an ongoing commitment to develop in consultation with and collaboration with disabled, chronically ill, and immunocompromised stakeholders, substantive plans to really change the course of the pandemic for my community.
In just the few seconds we have left, I do have a larger question about, you know, so many people who have developed long COVID have entered the disability community. And I'm curious, how has your work in disability rights been transformed by long COVID?
It is a mass disabling event, and it requires a massive investment of resources. It is transforming the healthcare service and delivery landscape. And our leaders cannot leave people who have acquired a disability through long COVID behind. Yes. We need substantial research into post-viral illnesses broadly. And that is a commitment that the Biden administration needs to keep and follow through on.
So sorry, we'll have to leave it there. That is Matthew Cortland, Senior Resident Fellow at Data for Progress. Thank you.
Thank you.
When a climate disaster hits, displaced people scatter, and many never return home. Reporter Katie Riddle has a story of a town in southern Oregon that's tried to prevent this kind of exodus.
Ask people in Talent, Oregon about the fire, and there's one thing you hear again and again. Until it happens to you, you can't understand.
I liken it to standing at the Grand Canyon for the first time. You just can't reconcile what you're looking at.
It's been 16 months since the Alameda Fire leveled this town. There were close to 7,000 people there at the time. Darby Ayers Flood cries when she recalls seeing her burnt down home for the first time.
There was a piece of the picket fence left and the cement staircase that went to the front door. And, you know, that's the front yard where I had birthday parties and a life there with my children.
She and her wife scrambled to pick up the pieces of their lives. Ayers Flood also had much bigger problems to think about. That's because she's the mayor of Talent. For guidance on rebuilding, she turned to some people with experience.
We listened to lessons learned from Paradise.
The town of Paradise, California, is about 4 hours to the south. It was gutted in a fire several years previous. Paradise saw much of their community slip away forever. Ayers Flood realized that FEMA's help would not be enough.
I want a yogurt.
You want a yogurt?
Natalie Gilbert is the sort of person the mayor feared would suffer the most. Gilbert's feeding her four-year-old son breakfast on this day. When the fire hit, Gilbert's house was destroyed, but she didn't have proof of a rental agreement and didn't receive any federal assistance. The fire radically increased rents overnight.
The rent is two or three times what your income is.
For more than a year, she and her four kids slept wherever they could find shelter. Until a few weeks ago, they were cramped in a tiny travel trailer on the outskirts of town.
Where we were at wasn't a doable situation.
Then Gilbert heard about the city's new housing project for displaced fire victims. It holds 52 RVs. They're twice the size of that trailer and brand new, walking distance to the kids' school. Gilbert's new home accommodates her whole family.
This couch also comes down and turns into a bed.
City leaders used over $2 million from private donations to build this transitional housing. At 12, Sarah is the oldest of the children in this family.
I like this area.
She's
like
sitting in her new living room. Having multiple rooms is a luxury.
There's a couch and there's the TV here.
Sarah seems happy on this day, but she's been withdrawn over the last year. Quiet.
For some kids, it's, you know, they shut down. They aren't interested in building relationships with friends or teachers or staff.
Tracy Koa says many students here have endured a pandemic, a natural disaster, and ongoing displacement. She coordinates social services at the school. There are at least 400 homeless students there.
I mean, there's families living in their cars.
Koa is working this month to move more of these families into the new RV development. Still, Mayor Ayers Flood estimates the town has lost at least 25% of its population. And she has a message for other communities facing disaster.
You have to act fast to get people back home.
That was reporter Katie Riddle in Talent, Oregon. And you are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From noshing to schmoozing to schlepping, many Americans know a handful of Yiddish words, but outside of ultra-Orthodox Judaism, few people actually speak Yiddish as a language. In this encore presentation, Dina Pritchett reports that the pandemic has created a wave of new Yiddish learning.
When the pandemic started, Emily Tamkin had some free time.
I wasn't commuting home or going out on Monday evenings, so why not learn Yiddish, right?
Tamkin's writing a book on Jewish identity, so learning the language of Central and Eastern European Jews made sense. But it was more than that.
It offered me this feeling of connection to my family at a time that I felt very disconnected.
And it connected her to this larger project of keeping the language alive after it was nearly wiped out by the Holocaust and assimilation.
There's all these people who came before me who did this. There's all these people around me now doing this. That's wonderful. It's a joy.
Yiddish culture has something to say about finding joy and ingenuity and creativity and resourcefulness in a time of crisis.
Ben Kaplan is the director of education at YIVO. It's an archive of Eastern European Jewish culture, which has been teaching in and about Yiddish for nearly 100 years.
And since the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen the classes grow in enrollment by 500%.
Yiddish centers from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires are reporting similar increases. Virtual Yiddish is a vibrant world with Yiddish Harry Potter.
Ich begrüße euch zu einem neuen Jahr in Hogwarts.
Yiddish yoga.
Auf Zurück. Aran in der Plankenpose.
Yiddish TikTok.
A Yiddisher Blick auf Beethoven.
Now, to be fair, the pandemic created a boom in language learning across the board. Cindy Blanco is senior learning scientist at the language app Duolingo.
We saw 30 million new learners in just those first weeks. And we actually saw really big spikes kind of every time a country would lock down.
But she says Yiddish is different. Over a third of their Yiddish students say culture is the number one reason for learning the language, with family right behind. Rebecca Margolis directs the Australian Center for Jewish Civilization at Monash University.
There's always something attached to why people decide they want to speak Yiddish. It's never because it's going to get them a job working in a bank or give them any kind of power in society.
Margolis, who's been studying pandemic Yiddish learning, says secular Yiddish has always been a chosen space. And people make that choice for a lot of reasons.
Descendants of Holocaust survivors for whom the language was deeply meaningful.
People who are drawn to the music and literature.
And then that youth vanguard of people who gravitate towards Yiddish because it's a queer space, it's a lefty space, it's a progressive space.
And as long as you aren't over-zoomed, or oisgezoomt, it can help foster connection at a time when community has been hard to find. For Yiddish student Emily Tamkin, it's been surprisingly meaningful.
Not to be like, I gained perspective by learning to conjugate Yiddish verbs, but it was not unhelpful.
And even on tough days, when Tamkin is dragging herself around, or in Yiddish, meschleppt sich, it's just fun.
It's a language that has survived. This is a language that is so full of life and joy, and it helped me hold on to all of that, too.
Because Yiddish has something to say after all these years, even, or especially, in these times. For NPR News, ich heiß Dina Pritchett.
Ich hab mir gewandert in a land of Freien, a Reus von Midder wie Mimitzrayim, gesucht an Ayem Jerusalem. Dus is a land for mir und dir. Dus land is dein Land, dus land is mein Land.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR. New?
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Here in the U.S., there's a lot of discussion about what it would take for the coronavirus to become endemic. In other words, a more predictable, seasonal virus like the flu or common colds. Well, in Africa, top scientists say much of the continent may have already reached that less threatening phase. NPR's Nurit Eisenman reports.
Like many countries in Africa, before the Omicron wave, Malawi didn't seem to have been hit too hard by COVID. Kondwane Jambo is an immunologist at the Malawi Liverpool Welcome Program. He says even by July of last year, when Malawi had already gone through several waves of the coronavirus, it looked like only a tiny share of Malawians had been infected.
Probably less than 10%. If we look at the number of individuals that have actually tested positive, maybe less than 5% even.
The number of people turning up in hospitals was also pretty low, even during the peak of each successive COVID wave. But Jambo knew this wasn't the full picture of what had been going on in Malawi. The country's population is so young.
The median age, for example, for Malawi is something like 17.5.
That most infections were probably asymptomatic ones that wouldn't show up through testing, let alone in hospitals. So Jambo and his collaborators turned to another potential source of information, a repository of blood samples that had been collected from Malawians month after month by the National Blood Bank. And they checked what share of those samples had antibodies for the coronavirus. Their findings?
For me, I was very shocked.
By the start of Malawi's third COVID wave with the Delta variant last summer, as much as 80% of the population had already been infected.
There's absolutely no way we would have guessed that this thing has spread that much.
Jambo thinks these findings explain a key feature of the current Omicron wave. The number of deaths this time has been a fraction of the already low number during previous waves. Now, barely any Malawians have been vaccinated, so Jambo says their apparent resistance to severe disease was likely built up as a result of all the prior exposure to earlier variants.
Now we have had Beta, we have had Delta, and the original. It seems like a combination of those three has been able to neutralize this Omicron variant in terms of severe disease.
And now that the Omicron wave has peaked across Africa, country after country there seems to have experienced the same pattern, a huge rise in infections that has not been matched by a commensurate spike in hospitalizations and death. Shabir Madi is a prominent vaccinologist at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa.
I think we should draw comfort from the fact that this has been the least severe wave in the country.
And he says there, too, the most likely reason is that immunity gained through prior infections. In South Africa's case, it came at a high price. Its population is substantially older than Malawi's, and during the Delta wave last summer, hospitals in South Africa were swamped. Still, the upshot, says Madi,
we've come to a point where at least 3/4, and now after Omicron, probably 80% of South Africans have developed immunity and at least protection against severe disease and death.
He and other scientists aren't quite ready to say the coronavirus no longer poses a danger in Africa. Emory University biologist Rustam Antia has been studying what it will take for the coronavirus to become endemic, the way the flu and seasonal colds are.
So the key question is how long does immunity that protects us from getting ill last?
But Shabir Madi says research suggests it could last at least a year. So Madi says in African countries and likely in many other low and middle income countries with similar experiences of COVID, the takeaway is already clear.
I think we've reached a turning point in this pandemic. What we need to do is learn to live with the virus and get back to as much of a normal society as is possible.
That still means taking steps to protect the vulnerable, says Madi. But he adds, any policy that's intended to stop future infections with massively disruptive restrictions isn't just unnecessarily damaging, but he says it's fanciful thinking. Nurit Eisenman, NPR News.
Since late December, a rare wayward eagle native to Russia and Japan has taken up residence along Maine's mid-coast near Boothbay Harbor. The Steller's sea eagle is one of the largest raptors in the world, weighing up to 20 pounds with an 8-foot wingspan. There are only about 4,000 of them left. And as Susan Sharon of Maine Public Radio reports, the chance to see one has captivated Mainers as well as birders from all around the country.
John Petrino isn't an avid birder, but he is a wildlife photographer. So when he got a tip that one of the world's rarest raptors had been spotted in his adopted hometown of Boothbay, He went out in a snowstorm to search for it.
It's right there. It's right there. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Petrino was live streaming video to his Man by the Sea Instagram account when he had the chance encounter.
CB, there it goes. There it goes. Guys, the Stellar Eagle is right in front of me. It's on the branch. Can you see it? Holy smokes.
Petrino is just one of hundreds of people who've been trying to get a glimpse of the unusual bird, whose size and grandeur make a bald eagle look like a lightweight. Mary and Kai Jenkins of Baltimore had planned on taking a trip to the Caribbean, but when their COVID-19 test results came back too late to board their flight, they made a quick change of plans and hit the road.
So we decided, since we're birders, we're in Newark, we'll come up here and try to find this bird.
This is what's known in the bird-watching world as chasing. The Jenkins are constantly on the lookout for rare species and will go out of their way to see them. It's been 3 days with no luck.
It's like baseball where you hit 333. That's good, right? Because you're not going to get 100%.
The Jenkins were among a group of birders from as far away as Texas, scanning the tree line above Boothbay Harbor for the eagle's flashy white feathers on its shoulders, legs, and tail, and its massive yellow bill.
Where is it?
He's above the tree line, moving to the right.
Where in the tree line?
He's going just to the right.
Oh, got it. Yeah. It's a gull.
Until recently, a Stellar Sea Eagle had never been seen in the lower 48 states. But in July, one was spotted in Quebec, then Nova Scotia. In mid-December, hundreds observed one in Massachusetts, and now in Maine. Because of the bird's unique feather patterns, it's believed to be the same vagrant. But the reasons for its lonely odyssey remain a mystery. Experts say it may have been blown off course or had an internal GPS hiccup. Mary Jenkins fears it is lost.
And I feel sorry for him because he's got, you know, it's the only one. I don't know if he's going to be able to make his way back to where he's from.
The good news is the bird can hang around with other eagles and is suited to winter weather. And the longer it sticks around, the more bird-watching enthusiasts it's likely to attract.
I want to learn about all bird species now. I want to find every bird I can, from the smallest to the largest.
As a photographer, John Petrino says he's always been focused on larger, charismatic animals like moose and fox. But the discovery of the Stellar Sea Eagle has changed his mindset, and he's joined the legions of fans eager to see where the bird shows up next. For NPR News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Avast, a global cybersecurity company with more than 435 million users. Avast is dedicated to helping people take control of their safety and privacy online. Learn more at avast.com. From Indeed, a hiring platform designed to help businesses of all sizes grow by attracting, screening, and interviewing candidates, all from the employer dashboard. More at indeed.com/NPR. And from Culligan Water, since 1936, a local Culligan specialist can provide in-home water tests and custom recommendations to treat the unique attributes of a home's water. More at culligan.com.